Hello again, and welcome to the first installment of a new podcast. This is the podcast of my story, Home Again, Home Again, which was originally published in one of the Tesseract's anthologies, The Best of Canadian Science Fiction. I'm actually going to be co-editing the next one of these, which is very exciting. It's my first anthology editing gig. This story came to me while I was doing two things. The first was snorkeling in a tide pool in Cuba, and the second was coming out of the water every now and again to read E.L. Doctorow's Book of Daniel. Doctorow's not a relative of mine, or if he is, he's such a distant one that I'm probably about as related to you as I am to him. But I really do like his writing, in particular this novel, The Book of Daniel, which is a kind of fictionalized account of the life of the children of the Rosenbergs, the couple who were executed supposedly for selling state secrets to the Soviets, and about their son, who was a fictionalized version of Abby Hoffman. Hoffman and Doctorow were friends. Doctorow was Hoffman's first editor when Hoffman was working on his early books. The book is really quite good, and it does this really cool thing, which is that it's autobiographical, and when the Daniel, the narrator, is talking about things that he finds uncomfortable, he switches to the third person, and then he switches back to the third person for the parts where he comes off looking good. And I thought that that was a really nice literary device, so I shamelessly lifted it, as they say, amateurs plagiarize, great artists steal, and used it here. I hope you enjoy this story. I'm hard at work on a bunch of writing projects this week. It seems like this has been the week of freelance article assignments. I must have written 6 articles this week. It's been a little mad. But I've also started work on a new novel. I know I haven't finished my other new novel. This one's going to be a kind of novel that I write between novels or in the spare moments while writing this other novel. It's a young adult novel called Little Brother, and it's a novel about subversive kids who use crypto to defeat a police state. It's kind of Encyclopedia Brown meets the Anarchist Cookbook by way of Bruce Schneier's Secrets and Lies. So I'm really excited about this book. It's been really just almost writing itself all this week, and I hope to have some stuff at least that I can get to my agent so he can start shopping it really soon now. Anyway, that's enough of me. On to Home Again, Home Again. Home Again, Home Again, by Cory Doctorow. Originally published in Tesseract 8 from Tesseract Press, 1999. Reprinted in the short story collection A Place So Foreign and 8 More from Four Walls, 8 Windows Press, 2003. The kids in my local bat house breathe heavy metals, and their gelatinous bodies quiver nauseously during our counseling sessions. And for all that, they reacted just like I had when I told them I was going away for a while, with hurt and betrayal, and they aroused palpable guilt in me. It goes in circles. When I was 16 and the amazing Robotron told me he needed to go away for a while, but he'd be back, I did everything I could to make him guilty. Now it's me, on a world far from home, and a pack of snot-nosed jellyfish kids have so twisted my psyche that they're all I can think of when I debark the shuttle at Aristide Interplanetary, just outside my dirty old Toronto. The customs officer isn't even human, so it feels like just another R&R, another halting conversation carried on in ugly trade speak, another bewilderment of queues and luggage carousels. Outside, another spaceport, surrounded by the variegated hostels for the variegated tourists, and bipeds are in bare majority. I can think of it like that. I can think of it as another spaceport. I can think of it like another trip. The thing he can't think of it is a homecoming. Homecoming. That's too hard for this weak vessel. He's very weak. Look at him. He's 11, and it's the tencennial of the ascension of his homeworld, dirty blue ball, so unworthy yet, inducted into the galactic fraternity and the infinite compassion of the bugouts. The foam, which had been confined to the newer process enclaves before the ascension, has spread, as has the cult of the process for lasting happiness. Process is, after all, why the dirty blue ball was judged and found barely adequate for membership. Toronto, which has seen half of its inhabitants emigrate on open-ended tours of the wondrous worlds of the bug-out domain, is full again, bursting. The whole damn planet is accreting a lair of off-world tourists. It's a time of plenty. plenty of cheap food, and plenty of cheap foam structures, built as needed, then dissolved and washed away when the need disappears. Plenty of health care and education, plenty of toys and distractions, and beautiful, haunting bug-out art. Plenty, in fact, of everything except space. He lived in a building that is so tall its top floors are perpetually damp with clouds. There's a nice name for this building, inscribed on a much-abused foam sculpture in the central courtyard. No one uses the nice name. They call it by the name the tabloids use, that the inhabitants use, that everyone but the off-world counselors use. They call it the Bat House. Bats in the belfry. Batty. Batshit. I hated it when they moved us into the Bat House. My parents gamely tried to explain why we were going, but they never understood, no more than any human could. The bug-outs had a test, a sci-fi helmet you wore, and it told you whether you were normal or batty. Some of our neighbors were clearly batshit, the woman who screamed all the time about the bugs and the little niggers crawling over her flesh, the couple who ate dog turds off the foam sidewalk with lip-smacking relish, the guy who thought he was Nikola Tesla. I don't want to talk about him right now. His parents' flaw, whatever it was too subtle to detect without the sci-fi helmet. They never knew for sure what it was. Maybe many of the bats were in the same belfry. Part of the bug-out's arrogant compassion held that the couple never knew which of them was defective, so his family never knew if it was his nervous, shy mother or his loud, opinionated father that had doomed them to the quarantine. His father told him, in an impromptu ceremony, before he slid his keycard into the lock on their new apt in the belfry. "Chet, whatever they say, there's nothing wrong with us. They have no right to put us here." He knelt to look the skinny 10-year-old right in the eye. "Don't worry, kiddo, it's not for long. We'll get this thing sorted out yet." Then, in a rare moment of tenderness, one that stood out in Chet's memory as the last of such, his father gathered him in his arms, lifted him off his feet in a fierce hug. After a moment, his mother joined the hug, and Chet's face was buried in the spot where both of their shoulders met, smelling their smells. They still smelled like his parents then, like his old house on the beaches, and for a moment he knew his father was right. This couldn't possibly last. A tear rolled down his mother's cheek and dripped in his ear. He shook his shaggy hair like a dog, and his parents laughed, and his father wiped away his mother's tear, and they went into the apt, grinning and holding hands. Of course, they never left the belfry after that. I can't remember what the last thing my mother said to me was. Do I remember her tucking me in and saying, "Good night, sleep tight, don't let the bedbugs bite"? Or was that something I saw on a vid? Was it a nervous command to wipe my shoes on the way in the door? Was it her face soft and sad, as it sometimes is in my memories? Or was it brittle and angry, the way she often seemed after she stopped talking as she banged around the tiny two-room apt? I can't remember. My mother fell away from speech like a half-converted parishioner falling away from the faith. She stopped visiting the temple of verbiage and dribs and drabs, first missing the regular sermons, the daily niceties of "good morning" and "good night" and "be careful, Chet," then neglecting the major holidays, the watch-outs and the ouches and the answers to direct questions. My father and I never spoke of it, and I didn't mention it to the other wild kids in the vertical city with whom I spent my days, getting in what passed for trouble around the Bat House. I did mention it to my counselor, the amazing Robotron, so called for the metal exoskeleton he wore to support his fragile body in Earth's hard gravity. But he didn't count then. The reason that Chet can't pinpoint the moment his mother sealed her lips is because he was a self-absorbed little rodent in those days. Not a cute freckled hellion, a miserable little shit who played hide-and-seek with the other miserable little shits in the Bat House, played it violently, hide-and-seek and break and enter, hide-and-seek and smash and grab. The lot of them are amorphous, indistinguishable from each other in his memory. All that remains of all those little clever brats is the lingering impression of loud boasting voices and sharp little teeth. The amazing Robotron was a fool in little Chet's eyes, an easy-to-bullshit, ineffectual lump whose company Chet had to endure for the mandatory hour every other day. "Chet, you seem distracted today," the amazing Robotron said, in his artificial voice. "Yeah, you know, worried about the future." distracted by Debbie Carr's purse, filched while she sat in the 68th floor courtyard, talking with her stupid girly friends. Debbie was the first girl from his gang to get tits, and now she didn't want to hang out with them anymore, and her purse was stashed underneath the base of a hollow planter outside the Amazing Robotron's apt, and maybe he could sneak it out under his shirt and find a place to dump it and sort through its contents after the session. What is it about the future that worries you? The Amazing Robotron was as unreadable as a pinball machine, something he resembled. Underneath, he was a collection of whip-like tentacles with a knot of sensory organs in the middle. You know, like, the whole frickin' thing. Like, if I leave here when I'm 18, will my folks be okay without me and like that? Your parents should be able to take care of themselves, Chet. You must concern yourself with you, Chet. You should do something constructive with your worry, such as deciding on a career that which will fulfill you when you leave the center. The center was the short form for the long, nice name that no one ever used to describe the Bat House. I thought, like, maybe I could be, you know, a spaceship pilot or something? Then you must study mathematics and physics. If you like, Chet, I can request advanced instructional materials for you. Sure, that'd be great. Thank you, Robotron. You are welcome, Chet. I am glad to help. My own parent was in a center on my world, you know. I understand how you feel. There is still time remaining in your session. What else would you like to discuss? My mother doesn't talk anymore. Nothing. Why is that? Your mother is... The Amazing Robotron fumbled for a word, buried deep in the hypnotic English lexicon baked into its brain. Your mother has a problem, and she needs your affection now more than ever. Whatever reason she has for her silence, it is not you. Your mother and father love you, and dream of the day when you leave here and make your own way through the galaxy. Of course, his parents loved him, he supposed, in an abstract kind of way. His mother, who hadn't worn anything but a bathrobe in months, whose face he couldn't picture behind his eyes, but whose bathrobe he could visualize in its every rip and stain and fray. His father, who seemed to have forgotten how to groom himself, who spent his loud days in the Bat's house workshop, in the Bat House's workshops, drinking beer with his buddies while they played with the arc welders. His parents loved him. He knew that. Okay, right, thanks. I gotta blow, okay? All right, I will see you on Thursday, then. But Chet was already out the door, digging Debbie Carr's purse from under the planter, then running, doubled over the bulge it made in his shirt, hunting for a private space in the anthill. The entire north face of the Bat House was eyeless, a blind, windowless expanse of foam that seemed to curve as it approached infinity. Some said it was an architectural error, others said it was part of the Bat House's heating scheme. Up in nosebleed country, on the 120th level, it was almost empty, sparsely populated by the very battiest bats, though as more and more humans were found batty, they pushed inexorably upwards. Chet rode the lift to the 125th floor, and walked casually to the end of the hallway. At this height, the hallways were bare foam, without the long wear carpet and fake plants that adorned the low-altitude territories. He walked as calmly as he could to the end of the northern hall, and then hunkered down in the corner and spilled the purse. Shit, but Debbie Carr was going girly. The pile was all tampons and makeup and, a spare bra. A spare bra! I chuckled and kept sorting. There were 3 pennies, enough to buy 6 chocolate bars in the black market tuck shop on the 75th floor. A clever little pair of folding scissors, their blades razor sharp. I used them to slit the lining of the purse when the door to 12525 opened, and the guy who thought he was Nikola Tesla emerged. My palms slicked with guilty sweat, and the pile of Debbie's crap, set against the featureless foam corridor, seemed to scream its presence. I spun around, working my body into the corner, and held the little scissors like a dagger in my fist. The guy who thought he was Nikola Tesla was clearly batty. He was wearing boxer shorts and a tailcoat, and had a halo of wild, greasy hair and a long, tangled beard. But even if he'd been wearing a suit and tie and had had a trip to the barber's, I'd have known he was batty the minute I laid eyes on him. He didn't walk, he shambled, like he'd spent a long, long time on meds. His eyes, set deep in the black pits of sleeplessness, were ferociously crazy. He turned to stare at me. "Hello, Sonny. Do you like to swim?" I stood in my corner, mute, trapped. I have an ocean in my apt. Maybe you'd like to try it? I used to love to swim in the ocean when I was a boy. My feet moved without my willing them. An ocean in his apt. My feet wanted to know about this. I entered his apt, and even my feet were too surprised to go on. He had the biggest apt I'd ever seen. It spanned 3/4 of the length of the bat house, and was 5 stories high. The spots where he'd dissolved the foam walls away with solvent were rough and uneven, and rings of foam encircled each of the missing stories above. I couldn't imagine getting that much solvent. It was more tightly controlled than plutonium, the subject of countless action-adventure vids. At one end of the apt stood a collection of tall, spiny apparatus, humming with electricity and sparking. They were remarkable, but their impact was lost in what lay at the other end. The guy who thought he was Nikola Tesla had an ocean in his apt. It was a clear aquarium tank, 50 meters long and nearly 17 high, and 8 meters deep. It was dominated by a massive Baroque coral reef, like a melting castle with misshapen brains growing out of it. Schools of fish, bright as jelly beans, darted through the ocean's depths, swimming in and out of the softly moving plants. 1,000 neon tetra, a flock of living quicksilver sewing needles, turned 90 degrees in perfect unison, and then did it again and again and again, describing a neat angular box in the water. Isn't it beautiful? I'm using it in one of my experiments, but I also find it very calming.